Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. This episode is recorded on Monday, October 2nd, 2017, starting at 8:01 p.m. in Denver, Colorado, and this is the 127th episode of the show. For more information about how to subscribe to the podcast and help support the production of future episodes by becoming a patron, please visit theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe. In this episode, I'm going to be talking with Adam Summer of the Exploring Astrology Podcast, and we're going to be answering some questions that were sent in by listeners of both of our respective shows. Adam, welcome to the podcast.
Chris, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you. The last time we talked like this was actually on your podcast, where we did an interview, I think back in June, where you talked to me about my recently released book, and that went extremely well. I'm still actually getting messages every once in a while from listeners who say that they're like mutual listeners of both of our shows and that they were really excited to see us come together for that one. So I'm excited now to have you on my podcast a couple months later.
I love hearing it. And I hear that often, by the way. A lot of my listeners too make sure that they tune into you every week.
Yeah. So, I mean, it seems like we have two of the most active, I mean, at least as I try to pay attention to, you know, what's going on in the astrological community, what other podcasts are happening. And it seems like we've got two of the most active sort of podcasts around at this point, and certainly two of the most engaged fan bases of people listening to it. You've actually been at this, though, I think a bit longer than I have. I did a podcast called Traditional Astrology Radio that I took over from somebody else in 2010. And I did that to 2012. And then I started the astrology podcast in 2012. But you've actually been doing yours for quite a bit longer than that, haven't you?
I started in March of 2009.
Wow. Okay. So yeah, you're coming up before too long here on like 10 years almost.
It's been an amazing journey. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, how has that been for you? Did you start it on a lark, or was it like a deliberate decision at that point to start the Exploring Astrology podcast?
I kind of always knew I would do a podcast when I finally had something either to say or that I was deeply interested in. And it was the latter that happened to me around that time in my life. And so the reason why I called it the Exploring Astrology podcast and not the Astrology podcast, and that was an idea naturally, was I didn't feel that it was going to embody what my intention was, because in the very beginning, the intent was to explore it. I didn't know a lot. I had read Tarnas's Cosmos and Psyche. I had a few astrology friends. I was using it with other work that I was doing. I was basically using astrology charts as diagnostic tools with clients.
Right.
But as you know, when astrology comes, it comes. And I just started taking in all the information that I could get. And one thing I noticed right out of the gates, because I was already a podcast listener at that time, there wasn't really any astrology podcast that I was wanting to listen to, right?
Right.
I was like, well, what I could do is I could create one and invite astrologers that I'm interested in onto the show. And so some of my first guests were like Stephen Forrest and Maurice Fernandez, and tried to get Jeff Green on the show. I was really into evolutionary astrology in the beginning, but his daughter came on instead. And it was just like a really solid list. And by the time I had 10, people were asking me if I taught astrology. I was like, oh no, what am I in for? Is this a thing, right? Is this what I'm going to be doing? And really kind of the rest is history. It's just been growing and my interest has never waned. And I love it. It's such an amazing thing.
Brilliant. Yeah. And so you come from more of we're actually from the same state, cause you lived in like Boulder for a while, right? And you live sort of not too far from there at this point, right?
A Jupiter cycle, Chris. I was realizing that earlier, that I moved to Boulder initially in 2005. And so, yeah, it wasn't that long after I moved here that Jupiter moved into Scorpio, which is about to happen. So yeah, 12 years on and off. And I usually live in the mountains outside of Boulder. Like right now I'm in Gold Hill.
Okay. Brilliant. And yeah. And so your background, I mean, that's one of the things that people were really interested by in terms of seeing us come together for that episode a few months ago, is that our styles are very different. And so they were curious how, if that would mesh well, if it would clash or what, and it ended up actually working out quite well. But you come from more of like an evolutionary astrology background, right?
Yes and no. I mean, that was my interest in the beginning, just because I suppose one of the first books I ever read was a Stephen Fulris book. And then I was actually roommates back in 2008 with Ari Moshe, who's an astrologer, evolutionary astrologer. So his influence was strong on me in the beginning. But once I started doing my own readings and kind of branching out, studying Vedic astrology and other things, I would not consider myself an evolutionary astrologer. So, okay. Yeah. Just to be clear, I'm not claiming that. Yeah.
Sure. And one of those questions I think that we'll talk about later will draw a little bit on your background and your interest in Vedic astrology and your use of the dasha systems, I think, right?
Sure. Yeah. And hopefully not too blasphemous of a way.
Sure. Hopefully. We'll see. All right. I'm trying to think of any other preliminary things before we get started here. So what we did is we both of us put out a call for questions where every once in a while I'll do a question and answer episode where an astrologer or two will join me in order to take some questions from the audience. And this time we switched things up a little bit and both you and I put out calls to our respective audiences for some questions and kind of got inundated with a huge amount of questions, which unfortunately we'll only have time to get to a small portion of those, but we've tried to take some questions from each of our audiences and sort of narrow it down to ones that seemed like they would be good discussion topics for both of us, essentially. And so what we're going to do is we've got some of those questions and we're going to go through them from some of our audience members and try to just use those as launching points for discussion and, you know, hopefully answer some of them to whatever extent we can from each of our different perspectives.
I'm excited.
Yeah, I think this is going to be fun. I'm excited to do it as well. So thanks for joining me in this little experiment. Yeah. So shall we start with the first one?
Starting gun went off in the distance. I heard it.
All right, let's do it. So the first question, this is from one of my patrons named Sheila Roer, who I hope I'm pronouncing her last name correctly. She says, I'll just read the question directly. She says, as you note in your book, she's talking about my book, Hellenistic astrology doesn't seem to pay a huge amount of attention to the lunar nodes. Then she goes on, she says, Babylonian astrology viewed the nodes as dangerous gateways to change, with dragons ready to charge into action. Many astrologers from different schools, whether medieval or theosophical or New Age, tend to favor the north node and view the south node as problematic. Some Jungian astrologers view the nodes as a key indicator of themes the person is seeking to balance in their lives, a view which she says, I find usually accurate and helpful with clients. So then she brings it together and she says, how, if at all, are you using the nodes in delineation? How much weight do you give transits to the nodes, nodal returns, or transiting nodes to natal planets? So that's Sheila's question. Thanks for sending that in, Sheila. So this I thought would be an interesting question because I think we do have somewhat different approaches to the nodes, and the nodes actually play a pretty major role in your approach. And I think that your logo for your astrology yeah. business, it has like the nodes in it, right?
Yeah. And the south node, which is funny because a fellow astrologer noticed that the other day and she doesn't even use the south node. She's like, why in the world would you have that as your logo? I was like, well, would you like me to give a full answer or just like a pithy one?
Right.
So I kind of like changed her mind about the south node, actually. But I think the way we should tackle this is, I know for you, you didn't use the nodes for quite some time, but you've begun to implement them a little bit again into your practice. Is that true?
Yeah. And I'm trying to think of how to approach that. I mean, do you want me to go first on that?
Yeah, go for it.
All right. So my thing with the nodes is that I, you know, observed very early in my studies because I started out just doing modern contemporary astrology, psychological astrology, paying attention to all the contemporary like leading authors. And in the late 20th century, in most of those like recent astrology books, when I got into the field in the early 2000s, the nodes are like this huge thing where for many modern astrologers, the nodes are like the most important thing in the chart. It's often the first thing that you go to. And there's a pretty much a pervasive belief that goes through many modern astrology books that the nodes that the north node has to do with like where you're going in the future and the south node has to do with your past. And it's often linked to the South Node being associated with past lives and the North Node being associated with the future or future lives or where you're headed in this life. And that has become such a pervasive sort of idea that it's just like dominant in just about any astrology book that you'll read. But one of the things that I was really shocked by starting in 2004, 2005, when I went to Kepler and I started studying older traditions of astrology from prior to the 20th century, is I was actually surprised to find that the nodes weren't, well, A, always as important in every other tradition, and they didn't necessarily put as much emphasis on them prior to the 20th century. But B, and perhaps more importantly, the meanings attributed to the nodes were often wildly different in other traditions of astrology. And one, there was not really any associations with the past life being associated with the South Node and the North Node, the future being associated with the North Node prior to the past few decades. And I realized that that's actually a very recent innovation where astrologers started treating the nodes as if they had to do with past and future lives. And that's true even in the Indian tradition where, you know, we know that sort of ideas of karma and reincarnation and stuff are very prominent in Hinduism in the Indian tradition. And so we sort of assume that they, modern Western astrologers often assume that Indian astrologers treat the nodes in that way as well. But it turns out that if you go back just a few decades in the Indian tradition, they don't really treat the nodes in that way at all. And while there's some contemporary Indian astrologers who are starting to be influenced by Western views of the nodes so that they're starting to integrate like past life ideas into the nodes in their contemporary works in Indian astrology, if you take it back a little bit, it's like they treat the nodes as being very different and not particularly pertaining to past lives at all. So my whole thing over the past, starting around the mid-2000s, was seeing all this diversity and how the nodes were being treated and wanting to sort of remove myself from that so that I could rebuild my understanding of the nodes from scratch without any presumptions about what they are or what they're supposed to do, because I realized that a lot of the presumptions that people were making were assumptions that it had always been that way, when in fact, that may not necessarily be the case. So I stopped using the nodes altogether in charts for a number of years. And it's only recently, over the past few years, that I've started to integrate them again in order to rebuild my understanding from scratch and try to work them in what feels like a natural and sort of organic way to me, while not trying to overdo them and make that the first thing that I immediately jump to, which it used to be. So that's pretty much it. That's basically where I'm at this point when it comes to the nodes.
And what brought you back into it, Chris? Them?
Well, I mean, not a lot, actually. It's just the fact that the nodes, while it's true, Sheila's point was partially true, that the nodes are not hugely present in the Hellenistic tradition. They did use the nodes and they do show up in charts. And there are a few different statements about how they should be interpreted in the Hellenistic tradition. So it's not like they weren't used at all. And so I've started to integrate them again because I understand now astronomically what the nodes represent. And that's given me more of an angle on understanding how they've been interpreted sort of traditionally in different traditions, and why sometimes one tradition will treat them like this and another tradition will treat them like this, and how that's being derived from the astronomical reality of what the nodes represent. And so that's why I'm starting to work them back in again, although I do think it has been useful for me to remove them from my practice, because then I feel like it's less of like a crutch where that's not the first thing that I go to anymore. And in some ways, I feel like that's been useful, because then I've been able to reorient and focus on other things that maybe used to be more of like a weak point for me.
There's more overlap than we think, my friend.
All right. So let's hear. So where are you at with the note? I mean, you're
in complete agreement, first of all, with everything you just said. The difference
have you noticed that about the Indian tradition, though, where it's like if you study the Indian tradition, it's weird that they don't really, at least not in older texts, it's starting to, like, I think in like Camilla Sutton's book on the nodes, she does treat it as having to do with like past lives and things like that. But I'm pretty sure that's coming from Western astrology, contemporary Western astrology, rather than from the Indian tradition itself, per se.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'll comment on that. Where I want to start is not really a handicap. We'll just keep it in quotes. Mm-hmm. That really my first moment with astrology, like I was not into astrology. I was into the I Ching. I was into the tarot. I was into yoga. I was into psychedelics. I was into all these things, but not astrology. And there was this one night back in 2006, it was a gathering, like a symposium of artists at a friend's house. And I got in this conversation with this guy who had been talking to a bunch of people about their chart. He was like looking at people's charts. And I didn't know my birth time. And so I just told him my birthday. And like real quick in his head, he calculated where my nodes would have been just by sign.
Okay.
And he said something to me that haunted me. And I think like any good astrology reading will do this. Like there will be something, one or two takeaways that haunt in a good way.
Right.
Just kind of nag at you. And he said something like, you need to stop seeking the grail and turn your face to the city and start talking about the grail. I was like, wait, what? He's like, just leave the mountain and enter the town or city. I was like, wait, no, like that's not what's going to happen here at that phase of my life. The trajectory was so far away from town and city, like where I wanted to be, where I wanted to go and stuff like that. And so not too long after that, I learned of astro.com. I casted my own chart, you know, how they have the interpretation reports. I was going through them, not getting too much out of it, doing my own research, got a book at the Boulder Public Library on the nodes, North Node Astrology or something like that. Celestial, I think her name came up in our last podcast. Celestial.
Oh, yeah. Celestial. She was one of my early favorite books as well. And most people don't know that that's like a, not a euphemism. What's the term? It's like a pen name.
Right. Moniker. Yeah.
Right. I didn't know that until very recently. So I always get a kick out of telling other people.
Celestial. So that was like the seed, I think, was through the nodes. And then it just kind of went by the wayside for a year or so. And Tarnas then released Cosmos and Psyche.
Really, really quickly, what are your node placement? Was it like Sag Gemini?
Oh, sorry. I should have said. Exactly. You got it.
Oh, it is Sag. Okay. Brilliant. Good. I'm glad I got that. So the mountain, you must have the south node in Sag and the north node in Gemini?
Exactly.
And that's what he's delineating. Okay. Nice.
Yeah, he just used that. But if he would actually looked at my chart, he would have went deeper into it because I have Neptune conjunct my south node. It's in the fourth house. That north node's in Gemini pointing into the 10th. It makes even more sense when you look at my actual chart.
Nice.
So anyway, a year or two goes by and Cosmos and Psyche comes out. Well, I had already been familiar with Rick's work because of his affiliation with Stan Grof and also a philosophy course in college. We had to read Passion of the Western Mind. So I was already into his work.
Nice.
And this book came out. And when I bought it, I really honestly had no idea it was about astrology. Wow. I just knew it was his second book.
That's so wild.
I'm like, I'm going to read it. Intimations on a New Worldview. And when I got into it, I was like, oh, sneaky bugger. It's about astrology. Because it's kind of sneaky in the beginning. It's like, you know, is this about astrology? Is it not?
Yeah, and then he doesn't mention astrology for the first 50 pages, I think.
Exactly. So it kind of snuck up on me. And then once it started, I was like, oh my God, this is the realm that I need to go deeper into. Because I knew it was like mainly tracking it through time, looking at it in a mundane sense, these cycles between planets. But of course, immediately light bulbs in my head. I'm like, there's implications of all of this in my chart with transits and the like, right? So it wasn't even 2 months after that that I met Ari Moshe. And then it began.
Okay. So you're one of those people who, like Tarnas's book, actually had a really profound impact. I mean, there's obviously other things and other, you know, intimations going on in your life in terms of astrology in that direction, but right. That book, did it influence you in a significant way?
It really did, because I think a lot of my issue with astrology before that, and really still to this very day, is just the lack of academic rigor, which you don't lack any of, as you know. And I just wasn't familiar with all of the great wizards that are alive, right? Because that is not what you are presented in the mainstream or in the papers or like in that birthday book that someone's going to give you and say, read your birthday. Like it's just not present in those ways. And then once it opened, like what Tarnas did was like open my mind to like, holy cow, there is something to this. And then the studies began.
Right. That's brilliant. I mean, I've met, you know, people like that, especially younger people who just picked up the book in the bookstore and had no idea and thought it was a book on philosophy because it's in the philosophy section in like Barnes and Noble and stuff like that. And then suddenly they've been introduced to astrology. And I think there's still some, you know, I don't know if we'll ever fully know how many people were first exposed to astrology like that in the mid 2000s, but the number is probably a lot higher than we realize from sometimes.
Yes, because his reach is in different communities as well.
Right.
You know, it's not just the astrological, which is amazing. And then his daughter as well, her work, the school, CIS. I mean, the tendrils go in different directions, which is kind of amazing.
Yeah, definitely. All right. So then you met Ari and sort of that, and that was it. You were into astrology at that point.
Yeah. Like we traded. I used to do medical Qigong work and other such things. And did that for him. He gave me a reading in a treehouse on a very cloudy day in Olympia, Washington. And it was just one of those readings that was so affirming, right? Didn't tell me anything I didn't know, just like really strong affirmations that were coming through, of course, Pluto in the nodes, which is like the backbone of EA.
Right, because he's, for those that don't know, Ari is like the protege on some level of Jeffrey Wolf Green, who's the founder of evolutionary astrology. Is that a good characterization?
I've never called him that, but yeah, I would say so. Absolutely.
Okay, so you immediately, it's like you're exposed to Tarnas's work, but then you came into contact with somebody who is like very high up in the EA community and would have placed, therefore, a lot of emphasis on the nodes and their sort of past life, future life values.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then he was just giving me his books. We were having conversations. He lived literally right across the hall from me and we became fast friends. And again, it wasn't my intention to become an astrologer. I was just using it in a very basic way for diagnostic reasons. Like pulses, not so good at doing it. Tongue, I'm all right at doing it. Certain other methods that I've learned along the way, all right. But the chart, right when I learned how to look at charts, it was kind of second nature to me. I was like, oh, this can be so helpful for people, right? And right. It was. And so people started inquiring about, can we actually like do a reading? Can we go deeper into this? I was like, I guess. I don't really do this, but sure. And once I started doing readings, I was like, I love this. We just sit here for an hour and explore this stuff. Oh my goodness. I could do it maybe.
Right. So it's like astrology as part of like a metaphysical sort of healing modality?
Kind of. An informing tool within it. But yeah, I would say it's within that category. And I just had a little itch that we're getting a little far off topic on the notes.
Sure. So but, bring it back. So, you know, at that point, you're fully into astrology, you're doing consultations and, you know, and how are you're using the nodes at that point?
Using the nodes for sure. And it was also around the time that Stephen released Yesterday's Sky. Mm. Which is my favorite book on the nodes. I love it. I recommend it to all my students. And it was also around the time that I started realizing the problem of past lives in astrology readings, which is kind of paradoxical, being that was kind of the momentum out at my back.
Right.
And then I was realizing, like, this isn't very helpful. And it doesn't mean that I don't believe in past lives. I've had some very strange encounters with the idea. But I'll get into some of my philosophy around it now. So I think that when we're talking about the nodes of the moon, we cannot forget that we're talking about the moon. All planets have nodes, right? Mm-hmm. And so the nodes of the moon is this idea that like, well, what is the function of the moon but to keep us safe and secure and successfully processing emotion and feeling and experience throughout our lives, right? And so through this, we develop behaviors and habituations and identities and all these different things to keep us safe and secure within some sort of an identity that allows us to be a functional and hopefully successful human being in this life. Stories. All stories come from this lunar idea. The actual moon and the nodes of the moon. And it's kind of this trifecta that relates to time in the sense of past, present, and future, which also I started noticing to be very problematic because the greatest present to unwrap is right here in the present moment. And so exploring too much of the past, especially a past that doesn't even exist in this life, is another thing to hold on to. And to go too deep into this idea of destiny or the future is also another thing to hold on to, or at least stretch our energy away from the present moment. And so there's this quote that I think really is at the centerpiece of my relationship to the nodes of the moon, is by Thich Nhat Hanh. He says, to understand past lives, look no further than the present moment. Mm. And so it's all here now. And so then the magic of the nodes, and they are chock full of magic, in my opinion, relates kind of to the idea that it is a dragon. And that's where, when I started studying Vedic astrology, yeah, it's problematic because Ketu and Rahu are very different than the way evolutionary astrologers or Jungian psychologists, but astrologers talk about this, right? They're shadowy planets. They're asuras. They're demon-like. Like, they are not, they're even treated as planets, but right. They are not the same, right? So this dragon idea, I've always been into mythology and storytelling as well. And I started noticing just in some of Campbell's work and some of this guy Martin Shaw's work, who I'm really into, that this dragon idea, this serpent idea, was so central to the monomyth, to the story, like we'll just say in a meta sense that we're all living, that it started to just kind of make sense while I was doing readings as well. I was like, this whole dragon thing is so fundamental in understanding, I think, a person's relationship to their story. And so the South Node then becomes not just past lives, but something that is, in the Ketu sense, the part of the dragon without a head. So it has no eyes. It has no nose to smell. It has no tongue to feel the environment around it, right? So it has no direction in this world. But it is a mystical domain. And if we were to entertain the past life idea, just to assume it's 10,000 past lives, an amalgamation of experience, that is the South Node, its sign, its aspects, and the ruler of it. You can see that story. Well, you got to be good at something around that, right? And there's some texts, I think it's David Frawley that talks about it, don't quote me on that, that siddhis or magical powers kind of seep out of the South Node. I couldn't agree more at this point. I think that the South Node and its story has so much to do with the most integrated part of a person's psychology. It even might even bleed into genetics, though I have absolutely no science to back that up. Where the North Node, which is the dragon's head, which is has no body, is kind of like the Buddhist idea of the hungry ghost. Whereas Rahu in the East is kind of like this materialistic, conniving, very intelligent entity that knows how to get power, knows how to succeed in the material world, right? Well, here we have cultural values in place that show us the difference. That if the North Node is destiny in the West and it's this hungry ghost demon in the East, we see a very big difference in what destiny means to these two different ways of thinking about reality, right?
Right.
And so the North Node, I do think, is a story that we're meant to write. It's kind of like a beautiful book with a great pen in the middle of it. It's like, if you have the guts to write this story, to face the dragon, there's a lot of synchronicity and there's a lot of meaningful experience that comes from it. But if you stay there for too long, like, it's very hard in my experience personally to turn off Rahu, to turn off the North Node, because it's this more type energy. It's very Mars-like. And that's the great test then, is like, all right, well, how can I actually lead Rahu to Ketu? How can I bring the head to the tail? How can I, in a way, create a circle out of time? Instead of thinking about it as this linear past, present, future idea, but instead this ever-present way of dealing with comfort, dealing with the call to action, right? So within the nodes, I think there are like these incredible stories that are just pregnant with potential within them. And I'll just give a quick example because I did it earlier today. I offer this thing called a complete reading. It's five different sessions, and one of the sessions is completely on the nodes of the moon. So we spend the entire reading going into all the implications of the nodes, their rulers in the natal chart, and then I illuminate all of the biggest transits to them up to this point in time. And it is my favorite reading to do with people, because by the end of it, the way that they understand themselves is remarkable. Like, I think it is something that lends into, say, the healing potential of astrology, right? That some sort of reconfiguration happens in their thinking about their story, about themselves in it. And it hopefully, in most of the cases, inspires them, right? So some of my take on it.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the interesting points that you brought up, because this gets us into some interesting territory where I'm not sure I've ever fully gone there. I've never had an episode about it, but about, you know, reincarnation and astrology and karma and things like that, because that was one of the things. It's like, it's funny because I got into astrology with the explicit purpose partially of wanting to know about past lives, and with the presumption that if you looked at the person's natal chart that it could tell you something about a person's past life. And one of the things that threw me off in some of my initial studies was I was surprised it wasn't like, you know, astrologer could look at a chart and say like you were a dairy farmer in like 16th century England or something like that. It's like you could make really maybe some broad statements about archetypally, you know, certain areas or certain themes that might have been prominent, but it's not like, as is the case with most astrology, it's not like you're looking into a crystal ball at like a movie screen of exactly what took place at some specific point in the future, but instead you're drawing on the symbolism in order to describe like themes that, you know, depending on the astrologer, you may or may not be comfortable going more or less far in trying to narrow that down and state with greater or lesser specificity what that symbolism means or implies. And yeah. So I was kind of surprised by that. And then I was surprised, and that made me a little bit more skeptical then of some of the statements about the specific past life or future life implications of certain nodal placements relatively early on in my studies. But then when I got to studying Indian astrology, I was really interested and surprised at how they treated it, just because I had this presumption. I think people often have a presumption that because karma and reincarnation are so prominent there, that they would have similar views as like the modern Western sort of New Age astrologers who are into karma and reincarnation as theories. But so much of Indian astrology really is just focused on this is the chart. The entire chart itself is the result of past karmas. So there's not some particular part of the chart that deals with past lives, or it's like Saturn is not the planet that is not the only planet that deals with karma. It's like the entire chart itself is the results of all of your past karmas. But the focus really for their astrology oftentimes is not about your past life or your future life. It's often very practical and very much, you know, this is your life right now, right here. And what do you want to know about it? And I always found that so interesting from a philosophical and sort of conceptual standpoint, because so much of contemporary astrology that I was into in the early and mid 2000s was very much about, you know, elsewhere, and was, you know, what happened in a past life to cause things to be the way they are now, or where are you heading in the future and how can you get there, and not necessarily so much just about describing the present. And in Indian astrology seemed to be much more focused on the present than I anticipated. And that in and of itself also sort of caused me to, I think, you know, go down in some ways a similar sort of line of thought as what you were describing when you were talking about that as well, in terms of, you know, what are we looking at and what's the value that we're placing on it, or what is it actually doing for the person that's like practically useful in order to engage in going that route? You know, is this serving a purpose, or what's the point of what we're doing with that?
More overlap. I agree with you completely. And I love that perspective that Vedic astrology has on the entire chart being that karmic imprint, right? Like, so I just want to say that. And also, you know, for all your listeners, I think it's true with all planets, but especially the nodes, that you can begin to grok their meaning just by looking at their symbols, right? Like when you look at the south node, it looks like a U, it looks like a cauldron or a cup. It's holding something, right? And within that content, like I like to think about it, like there's colors that are even described of K2, where there's kind of like this violet, blue, teal, gray kind of smoke coming out of it. But like when you're in it, like when you put your face in it, like a scrying mirror, like maybe you can see past lives, but I'm really not that interested in it. I'm not. Like there's enough that has happened in this life of memories I can't remember, because before 3 years old, like everything is kind of a blank. In perinatal trauma, what it was like inside of my mom for 9 months, like all of that is more interesting to me, as far as like understanding the psychology, understanding trauma, understanding how it shows up in the chart, than past lives. And again, I've had weird past life experiences for sure, But I just don't think it's that helpful to spiral back into another life, especially when you're creating extravagant fictions. Has anyone ever told you the reincarnation of Valens, Chris?
That I was the reincarnation of Valens? No, we did once look at our asteroids and when I was at Project Hindsight and, you know, see who had prominent, like, ancient astrologer named asteroids conjunct, you know, certain places in their chart. But I think that's as far as I've gone.
Nice. I've been told a few things. Like, I had a listener, because I give my chart out sometimes in the show, and I had a listener tell me that I was Galileo.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, that's reasonable. I mean, if he had said, like, higher, like Kepler or, you know, Ptolemy or something, then that would have been a bit too far. But Galileo is a decent mid-tier. I could see that.
Cool. Yeah.
In terms of just, you know, not making too extravagant of a claim, like, that seems more reasonable.
And question, did he also die with the water hemlock like Socrates?
Who? Galileo?
Galileo. How was he?
I think he was under house arrest for like the last decade of his life, and he wrote some of his most important works during that time, but I don't remember what the very end was.
Okay, yeah. I might be just thinking of Socrates. I was going to bring something up about that plant.
Okay.
Anyway, so I'm with you on that. I just don't really find in counseling work, because really my main intention in working with people, and this is actually a few of the questions that can like bleed into this as we segue into something else, but like, what does a reading look like? Like, what is my own intention and purpose of even doing this work? Well, I want to help. Like, I know how astrology helped me and inspired me and gave greater context to my life and continues to do so. But also what it does, like, even knowing the littlest bit of astrology, is it gives you a consistent relationship to magic. Like, there's something stunning about an astrology chart every single time you engage with it. You would agree, right?
Yeah, yeah. Somebody asked me about that actually earlier today, and he asked if you ever lose that. And I said, no, I've never lost that, you know, feeling. And I feel like if I did, there would be seriously something wrong, because there is, and this actually brings up a question that somebody else asked that hopefully we'll get to later, which is, you know, that disconnect between the realization of how weird astrology is and how different that is from the contemporary, like, modern worldview about the nature of the cosmos and everything else. And if you're not constantly still, even as a seasoned astrologer, like, surprised and shocked and kind of awed by that, then you've kind of lost touch of, you know, where astrology is relative to the sort of current understanding of the world.
Yep. You've hit a plateau. You've stopped inquiring and asking big questions, and you've just gotten lazy, my friend, if that happens.
Yeah,
it's always there.
Or just taking for granted, like, your worldview almost, like, too much. Like, of course astrology works, or saying, like, you know, of course, our lives are somehow mapped out to greater or lesser extent ahead of time. Of course that's a thing. And it's like, no, you have to stop every once in a while and think that's still a really, I don't want to say crazy, but that's still a pretty wild proposition by, like, any stretch of the imagination. And so I'm still constantly surprised and fascinated that that's a thing, that astrology is a thing.
Me too. I mean, I think that both of us are probably by default skeptically minded. Are you? Have you always been?
Yeah. I mean, I think it waxed and waned at different points. I mean, I used to be more into conspiracy theories and things like that, but I definitely, you know, probing and trying to understand and gauging the sort of evidence for something against the arguments against it. So yeah, I've definitely had more of a skeptical bent in many ways.
Mm-hmm. And it's things like astrology that's almost like a reward for that depth of inquiry. Because I know for a lot of my friends that are astrologers or just really into it, it just kind of surprises them way along the road of whatever it is that they've been trying to find, right? They've been seeking something, and I definitely was. And astrology was not a road marker on the map or the sign that I was moving towards. And then when it came, I was like, what is this? Like, all of a sudden, I just, like, fell into this vortex, and then it just keeps spinning. And every single time I engage with it, whether it's a conversation like this or looking at charts or teaching, it doesn't really matter. I am in constant awe of the holographic nature of reality, first of all, because there's just no way to logically explain some of the stuff, like subdivisional charts and solar return charts, composite charts. Like, I know you're going to have a podcast on that soon. Like, all of those things, when you really think about them, it's impossible, right? Like, it's impossible to have transits to your own chart, transits to a solar return chart, a lunar return chart, DASAs running, zodiacal releasing, perfections, all these things running at once. And they all are true. How?
Right. What do you mean by that phrase, the holographic nature of the universe?
I just feel that this is a segue into DASAs, I think, because just the idea of the hologram or Indra's net, for example, that like whatever jewel you look into, because they're all connected, you see a mirror of all of the other jewels in the sense that anywhere you look, like in some sense, you're the center of the universe, or that point is, and it kind of just holographically appears. Quantum mechanics is stumbling into this quickly, right? That, to me, one of the most mind-boggling things about astrology that I've ever discovered is how the Vimsodari Dasa cycle works with Western transits. Makes no sense. But with the way I use it, it's 100% accurate as far as what I'm looking for.
Okay.
And that doesn't make any sense to me because it's, you know, it's based off nakshatras. It's quite old. It's a no-no to do that. In every book I've ever read on it, it's like, you can't do that. I'm like, you can't? Let me see. Let me try. And I'm like, well, there's something. And there's something again. I've been using it like that for 7 years.
I mean, that might be kind of interesting in terms of, I did a show not long ago interviewing, there's a growing contingent, still very small minority, but some Vedic astrologers who are using the tropical zodiac, but using sidereal nakshatras.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe we can get to that, I don't know, later. So we spent the first 40 minutes just talking on our first question. I'm increasingly realizing that we were much more ambitious there's like 10 other questions. There's a dozen other questions that we have lined up. There's no way that we're actually getting to all this tonight. So we have an option here. We can keep expanding on, because I think we could actually keep talking about, and I always meant to do an episode on the nodes.
Sure.
I'm not sure that if this is right to turn it all the way into a complete one, but I think there's still a few points we could go back to on that and just keep expanding on that and see where it takes us.
We can even podcast swap too and like take these questions over to my show at some point and then back and forth if people like it.
Yeah, I think that's actually a great idea. So we could hit some of the more questions and do a separate one and release it on your podcast. And then we don't have to, because I want to get to their questions, but I don't want us to have to feel pressured to move on from like an interesting discussion point and just in order to get through them.
The moon's in Pisces, Chris. Let's just kick our feet up. What are we talking about again?
Good point. The moon is with Neptune in Pisces applying. I guess we did pick that as our electional chart for tonight. Yeah. All right. So one point I want to come back to with the nodes, I mean, because I don't want to hark on it, but it's like, because I haven't talked about the nodes that much on my show, because I haven't, you know, focused on them a lot for years, maybe this would be a good time to present part of like my research on that. And one of the things is, okay, so it's like one of the things I try to do is I wrote up a whole paper, it was probably 10 years ago now, where I tried to trace the history of the nodes and how they were used in different traditions. And I also tried to trace like the modern history of, you know, when did everyone start talking about the nodes in a past life and future life context, if this is something that, you know, doesn't show up if you go a few centuries back. And it turned out that you can actually trace most of the modern approach to the nodes back to Dane Rudyard's first book, which was, the name is escaping me at the number. What was it? It's like the psychology
of self.
Yeah.
What is it called?
Oh man, I can't believe I'm forgetting it, but yeah, it's the, his first book, which was published in like 1936. Dane Rudyard, let me search for it.
Yeah, just look it up.
Oh, The Astrology of Personality.
There you go.
Okay, so The Astrology of Personality, it was published in like 1938, I believe. And what you see is like later in the book, he has this really pretty small section, and it's kind of this almost like throwaway section where he starts talking about the nodes. And Rudyard's thing was that he was trying to go back to first principles, and he was trying to understand and like reconstruct or create an astrology anew in modern times by going back to first principles and looking at the symbolism and then trying to extrapolate from basic things like the basic astronomy of something or other things like that, what its astrological significance was, or he was trying to create sort of grand paradigms or constructs like the lunation cycle as a construct, or looking at everything like the tropical zodiac in the context of like cycles and how that might extend to, you know, the aspect doctrine and how different cycles like that might inform the nature of the aspects with waxing aspects versus waning aspects and everything else. So in The Astrology of Personality, which is his first book, which is extremely early in his career in the like mid-1930s, and he lived all the way until the earlier mid-1980s. So we're talking about pretty early on in his career. He has this like throwaway section where he starts talking about the nodes, and he starts talking about their astronomy and how, you know, that the north node is when the moon begins ascending upwards, and the south node is when the moon begins descending downwards in terms of latitude and declination and everything else. And so then he extrapolates from that. So he says, so then this must explain why, or this is part of the reason why the north node has traditionally been associated with growth and increase. The south node has been traditionally associated with decrease, which is true that in the medieval tradition, that's one of the primary ways that the nodes were treated, was the north node increases whatever it touches and the south node decreases whatever it touches. And then by extension, they would say, so it's good to have the benefics with the north node because it will increase their beneficence, and it's bad to have the malefics with the north node because it will increase their maleficence, and vice versa with the south node. So then he sort of has this, once he gets to that point, he has this throwaway line where he almost starts to speculate and just sort of riff on this idea from a philosophical standpoint as a theosophist, or at least earlier in his career, he was much more influenced by theosophy, I think, than he was later on. And he says, so then perhaps we could say that the north node might have to do with, you know, the development of one's life in the future, and the south node may have to do with things that happened in terms of a person's past lives. And then that's the end. And he basically like moves on to the next section, essentially.
Yeah.
So this is a paraphrase, and I'm butchering it in terms of details, but generally speaking, that's what happens, and like that's it. And as far as I can tell, all modern treatments of the nodes really go back to that, what was essentially like Rudyard just sort of speculating or riffing on this based on the astronomical significance in this book in 1938. And then what happens is like eventually we have this influx of astrologers in the 60s and 70s as part of the New Age and the counterculture movement. And that book by Martin Shulman, who wrote on the nodes, he wrote a whole series. One of them was on the nodes. One of them was on the part of fortune and other stuff like that. But he connected the nodes, I think being influenced by Rudyard, with past and future lives. And then from that point forward, because I asked Stephen Forrest at one point, like where did he get the idea that the north node has to do with the future and the south node has to do with the past? And he said he just assumed it had always been in the tradition, because by the time he got into the astrological community and he read Shulman's book, you know, it became a pretty common idea. And then from that point forward, from the 60s and 70s forward, it just it explodes into this common presumption that everybody's making, that's sort of like a shared approach to the nodes. And that brings us to the point we are at today. So I was always just fascinated by that, and I wanted to mention that as part of my background context for why I got kind of startled and wanted to take a step back from the nodes for about a decade, just because of realizing how, when looking at it from a purely historical standpoint, something that could be so pervasive and taken as an assumption in modern times could be such a recent development. I was kind of surprised by that. And that was one of my early forays into, you know, this intersection between looking at astrology from a historical and cultural standpoint versus a technical standpoint, and how sometimes that can be important or useful just in terms of giving greater context about how the techniques developed and where they came from.
Absolutely. So the nodes have become a meme. In other words, they're kind of like a meme. Like it came from like a sentence, or maybe from some of his lectures in the 30s, 40s or something like this. And then it kind of just nestled itself within the collective, and then everyone started talking about it and using it and relating it in that way. I observe this too. It's not a complete overlap, because I don't think I've completed that book. I've read a few other of Rudyard's, but when I first did get into Rudyard's work early on, I noticed that about his relationship, probably way later on, like in the 60s, like that content that he was producing. But my question immediately was, how come I don't remember Jeff Green talking about this? You know, like referencing Rudyard and stuff. I was like, it's like identical, like with how they're talking about these nodes. And I just thought for some reason, just like with my little knowledge of EA, that it was kind of like channeled or brought forth by dreams and experience and stuff like that by Jeff Green. Like, at least that was like kind of the cliff notes of the original story. And then I discovered that. And then I started having my own experiences with it where I was like, yeah, it's roughly related to this. But this will stitch in a question from earlier where, what was her name? Or yeah, Sheila, she asked it about transits of the nodes to and from, I'm going to say, just watch it, especially once in a lifetime transits and or progressions, solar arcs. And what is your experience of that? And it will help you understand the very simple understanding of north node more, south node less. And if you think about them as stories, like wherever the north node is transiting, for example, wherever the eclipse happened on August 21st was where the north node in Leo is transiting. Wherever that's at in your chart, if it's hitting anything sensitive, you can think about it and start to see like, oh, there are more additions to the story in that area. There could even be really exciting quantum-like leaps in that part of the story in your life. Whereas the south node that's in Aquarius at the moment, wherever that's falling, things are falling away. Stories are falling out, right? They're spilling over. Like they're no longer needed anymore. And I find that to be incredibly helpful in client work. Because if there are stories running, for example, using an extreme case of someone that is really suffering from PTSD, right? And they can't help but cycle that story, that memory, right? From that time. I mean, the brain has basically rewired itself to viscerally experience that. And I think that's a south node experience. Well, with the help of certain treatments, maybe a little bit of MDMA or something like that, like there can be to be catapulted almost into the north node to see beyond the confines and the walls of this story, this identity that is an illusion that you've constructed around whatever the trauma is. And we're all traumatized. Don't get me wrong. It's not just PTSD. Like we all have been born. And so there's some sort of trauma around us, but like life is tough, right? And so I think that with the south node patterning and with the moon, like we do construct stories that keep us safe. And that can be very problematic when it comes down to just keeping things moving, to feel like we're progressing or evolving. Not that we have to go anywhere, but at least moving energy to where we feel radiant and content most of the time. You follow?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I liked something you said where you're talking about, you know, look at what happens when the nodes transit certain points or when certain points transit to the nodes. And because that brings up a really important point here. And that was really the main thing that I wanted to do, where I wanted to distance myself initially from them so I could rebuild my understanding of them based on more of an empirical understanding of looking and actually seeing what they seem to be doing and then drawing my own conclusions, rather than taking it for granted what they meant based on this sort of inherited tradition that made certain assumptions about what they already meant and signified. Because that's like a constant tension in astrology and in the astrological community. And I feel like it's always been that way because there's this pull between, on the one hand, like empiricism and trying to figure things out, what astrology means and what different things in astrology, what different planets signify or what the houses signify or whatever it is based on, you know, repeated observations over long periods of time. And there's like that whole empirical side of astrology. But then there's also this other side, which is just purely sort of like a symbolic extrapolation or like extrapolation of what things mean based on symbolic reasoning and symbolic sort of inferences that, for example, you know, in traditional astrology, they said that if a planet was under the beams, if it was hidden, if it was too close to the sun, then you couldn't see it and it was hidden quote unquote, underneath the beams. And therefore, whatever that planet signified would sometimes be interpreted as being hidden or obscured in some way. Like if the planet signified relationships and it was under the beams, then they would interpret that as meaning that the person would have secret relationships or would be married in secret, is one of the delineations from like Retorius in the 7th century. And so that's not empirical. That's purely sort of a symbolic extrapolation that somebody's coming to just by thinking about sort of abstractly what that symbolism means, and then creating or generating a delineation based on that of what then it should signify in the world in general, based on that, whether or not they've actually ever seen that occur before. And so that's one of the areas where we run into the nodes that worried me, just because if you use them primarily or too much in a past life context, then it's hard to really have much of like an empirical basis for those statements at all, because you're making statements about, you know, things that there's no way to verify, and instead you're relying almost entirely on, you know, the symbolic extrapolation to some extent, or another version of that or branch of that, which is just what does the inherited tradition say about that, whether or not it has any empirical basis, and then applying the inherited traditional assumptions to generate a delineation.
Can I interject real quick about that? Because I agree with you, but there is context for being able maybe to have that content to work with. For example, I do know of a few of astrologers that do past life regressions in conjunction to their readings.
Right.
Right.
Patricia Walsh, I think, is somebody I've talked to before who does past life regression, and she uses that in an attempt to like empirically validate information she's getting about past lives from the chart.
Right. A student of mine learned with her, does the same thing. Also, holotropic breath work, which is work that Groff and Tarnas did together, and I've actually done that myself. Led holotropic sessions with a friend who does that, and then given readings to everybody afterwards. That's interesting. Wow. And then I think there's other contexts too that maybe you could do it. Like, you know, ayahuasca has spread its vines around the planet pretty successfully. And I think the combination between those experiences and astrology readings is also probably pretty helpful, because then you can see it. You can see like, oh my goodness, like if it is an old story that a person is releasing, and maybe they do slide through some rabbit hole into a past life experience, and they have these imprints, they have these cathartic moments. That's real for them, right? It doesn't matter if it's a figment of the imagination or it's real or not. That's their experience. And so I'm totally in favor or okay with a person bringing a story to me that they had, not telling me that they were, you know, some high Cleopatran type priestess in a different life or anything like that, but like something real, tangible that could help with their healing process, right? And then you can always see it in the chart in relation to the nodes or their rulers. And then we have content to work with. But I'll never paint a fiction for someone, because I already gave my reason of one of them why. But also, I just don't think it's fair for me to attempt to do that.
Well, and I mean, that's the question is, you know, it's like, I don't have a problem if you're just straight out saying, I mean, I don't have a problem either way. I mean, people can do whatever they want in terms of the astrology.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But, and, you know, that should be said from the outset. But I'm just saying in terms of my personal, because it's so funny, because that literally was, I got into astrology because I was reading books on Nostradamus, where this person was a past life regress. She was a hypnotherapist who supposedly regressed like patients, and then writes this whole story about going back into past life and finding like a student of Nostradamus's, and then they go about attempting to interpret his prophecies based on that. And that was literally my entrance into both the New Age field, that sort of community, as well as astrology. And so my background is very much tied up in all of that. So it's not that, you know, I don't know anything about it, or I'm completely antithetical or hostile to it in terms of my background. I just had become more and more skeptical because, you know, when I did start talking to, for example, a person who was trained by that author who did past life regressions, and she was a psychologist herself, she said that she did sometimes have questions about how much the person under hypnosis was actually reliving or talking about something that was a genuine, you know, thing that occurred historically in a past life, versus how much they were developing or talking about some sort of narrative that was coming from some deep thing in their like background or like their childhood background in this life.
Yeah.
But that the narrative itself was almost more of like a convenient way to describe that in a way that was, you know, easier to cope with rather than, you know, actually talking about what happened in this life. And I guess that's one of the questions sometimes when it comes to some of this stuff, and you had brought that up earlier, which is whenever you're looking at things that are supposed to indicate past, you know, traumas or things that happened in the person's past, it's oftentimes just seems so ambiguous if this was something that happened earlier in the person's life or is in the person's like family background or ancestral background or sort of cultural background versus going back before that and saying that this is something that a person is bringing in from elsewhere, from some other lifetime. That ambiguity always made me uncomfortable the more and more I learned about astrology, because it never seemed fully possible to say for sure which it was.
The moon is a sticky substance, Chris, right? Like, I think, for example, with what you're saying, like every experience that we have, all the movies we watch, all the books we read, all the stories we hear people tell us, well, some of that's probably going to stick to the moon. Also, I think it's a dream catcher. I think that we dream through the moon, that the landscape we go to every night is more Neptunian. It's universal. But like, I'm never going to dream of your parents. You're never going to dream of mine. Likely, you might if you're like got those psychic staffs in your hands, or like you're holding some sort of a, I don't know, feather that has powers in the dream world. But I think that too can carry over. A lot of people can be delusional around like what's real, what's not real, right? Reality tunnels are varied within all of us. And so you're right. Like, is it tangible past life material? Where does it come from? Does it matter? I think it all matters. But what is most useful is the question it seems like you've always been asking. Like, is it useful? Is it legitimate for me to actually utilize this in my practice? And I too am always asking it. But the nodes for me, like when we were talking about like consistently getting the feedback from astrology of awe and validity through that magic, I get so much of it from the nodes consistently. And so there's no way I would ever abandon them, nor would I ever abandon the South Node. And help me understand where that comes from, Chris. Why does astro.com, I think, and Solarfire by default not include it? Is it a Uranian astrology thing? Where does it come from?
Where does what come from? The true node thing?
No, not true or mean. That astro.com by default does not include the South Node.
Oh, they just include the North Node. I mean, I guess. I don't know. That's a good question, because that always does annoy me as well, because I always, when I put them in charts, it's like I'll do both the North Node and the South Node. So that's a good question.
It's just annoying. I'm like, oh my goodness. And that was the conversation I had the other day with a colleague, because she doesn't use it either.
Use the South Node?
Uh-uh.
Oh, right. Because that's one of the funny things is that because it's this intersection in modern astrology between sort of progress oriented, not progressive, I'm not thinking of the right word, but it's like encouraging progress oriented sort of positive astrology as like one major trend in modern astrology, like the desire and the attempt to use astrology as a tool for self-development and growth and things like that, you know, automatically then classifies the North Node as positive, and ironically ends up sort of almost indirectly or accidentally classifying the South Node as negative or malefic, because it represents your past and where you've been, but that you should be like moving towards your North Node. So that's actually, you know, I don't know if I've heard it going that extreme, but that sounds like an extreme manifestation of that sort of thing with the person you're talking about, if they're only using the North Node and not the South Node.
It's important for all your listeners to know about this, especially if you're just getting into astrology, because I think Solarfire does it too. I don't know that for sure. It's been a long time since I've configured my displayed points, but I remember something like that. Astro definitely does it. And so if you're just getting into astrology and you just don't know much about what we're talking about, make sure you put the South Node in there, because I think it's a really dangerous idea to just focus on that idea of the future. Like, there is so much that exists within the South Node that is, I think, vital material for really understanding who you are. Go on.
It's like, I'll have to ask them about that. But honestly, I think that's probably just like a programmer thing where they're just like, it's not necessary because the South Node's exactly, always exactly 180 degrees opposite the North Node. So we don't need to display it. Honestly, yeah. Like knowing some of the Astrodean skies, that's probably their rationale for that. So that's funny if that then accidentally generated a tradition of astrology in modern times where some astrologers just aren't using the South Node because it's not displayed in the chart.
Yeah. Is it like that with Part of Fortune and Spirit too? Is that why they don't include it? Because they are opposite, right?
They're always equidistant from the ascendant because you take the distance between the sun and the moon, and then you recreate that distance with the ascendant, and then the lot of spirit and lot of fortune always are the same distance either above or below the ascendant from each other. But it's like the lot of fortune, the issue there is actually that Ptolemy, the only lot that he used was the lot of fortune, and he dismissed all other lots as being like fanciful or something like that. Like he didn't like them, but he thought the lot of fortune was okay, so he kept that. And that was the only Hellenistic text from the second century that was continuously transmitted and translated into different languages over the past 2,000 years. And so that's the reason why the lot of fortune is in all charts, but other lots, like a lot of spirit, aren't.
By the way, I can't help but think of Neil deGrasse Tyson and putting his face on Ptolemy when I think about him now because your example on my podcast.
Right. Yeah. Cause Ptolemy is like the example is it's like if somebody like Neil deGrasse Tyson or like a, you know, his predecessor, Carl Sagan wrote a book on astrology where he tried to, you know, draw together a bunch of different scientific fields and create like a grand unified theory that brought them all together. That's basically what Ptolemy would be, in the second century. And that doesn't necessarily make him a practicing astrologer, but maybe more of a like a theoretician or something like that.
It's a tough comparison for me because I think if Sagan wrote an astrology book, it would be poetic, but shit. Same with Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know? So is that how a lot of historians or Hellenistic astrologers like view Ptolemy, or is that you just kind of tongue in cheek talking about it in that way?
I mean it's really it goes back and forth because it's like Ptolemy prior to the 1980s, Ptolemy was the only book that as I said, was that survived from that early form of astrology. For centuries, you know, English astrologers assumed that Ptolemy was like the most representative of the Roman astrologers around the second century. But then all of a sudden, the past few decades, a bunch of texts were recovered of other people who lived around the same time frame. Sometimes people like Valens, who lived in the same city in Alexandria in Egypt in the second century as Ptolemy, but their approach is just like radically different. But you can see that Valens is a practicing astrologer who's writing books to his students and who uses a bunch of chart examples, like over 120 chart examples, where Ptolemy never uses a single one. And so there was this, when that was discovered and that comparison started happening in like the 1980s forward, there was like this reactionary movement against Ptolemy where some astrologers like James Holden and to a lesser extent, Geoffrey Cornelius were like, Ptolemy wasn't even a practicing astrologer necessarily. And instead, these other guys were clearly practicing astrologers, and we should pay more attention to them. And so it was almost too extreme of a movement against Ptolemy, and I feel like that's starting to be balanced out yet. So I don't want to go too far in saying that he wasn't an astrologer or that he didn't know anything about the subject, since we don't, you know in all honesty, and the truth is probably somewhere in between. But certainly his approach was much more theoretical, and the approach of somebody like Valens was much more, you know, this is his empirical work on astrology.
Got it.
So again, it's that reoccurring theme of empiricism versus, you know, developing things based on sort of abstract symbolic extrapolation.
I got a question that might be the question of questions around some of this stuff. If the Library of Alexandria did not burn to the ground, do you think we could have been privy to some information about the nodes that could be helpful in the 21st century or eclipses or all of this?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, we're missing, because what sucks is that the texts that we have are from the first and second century CE. And those are like the earliest texts we have of like Greco-Roman horoscopic astrology. So the system of astrology that we still use in the West, essentially, or at least the basics of it, the fourfold system that has planets, signs, houses, and aspects, like the earliest text we have that has all of that system show up in the first century. But what sucks is that it's already like a second generation of astrologers at that point, and they're drawing on an earlier collection of texts that were written in the first century BCE or slightly earlier that were like the foundational texts of that tradition, but none of those survive. And so we've lost all of those, and we just have like this second and third generation of Greco-Roman astrologers who are reporting on what the founders said, but we don't actually know what the founders' works actually looked like, which is incredibly frustrating. I'm still holding out hope for like a, you know, a Dead Sea Scrolls type discovery someday of like some, you know, sheep herder in like Egypt discovers like a hidden cave that has, you know, jars in it that contain like all of the foundational texts of Western astrology.
Well, maybe if the digging continues at Göbekli Tepe, there will be some discoveries, because there is astrological etchings on what has been excavated up to this point. Have you seen them?
Oh, right. So some, we're talking about like way back, like not Paleolithic, but like ancient sort of stuff in Egypt, right?
So Göbekli Tepe, I do believe is in Lebanon. Okay. It's close. It's in there, but like because of everything that's been going on in that area of the world, the digging has ceased, and also the main guy who was leading the excavation died.
Oh, wow.
So Graham Hancock, in his latest book, Magicians of the Gods, it starts there, talking to this guy at the site. And as far as I know, there might have been something even more recent that has been discovered that's older than this, but like it blows our whole understanding of history out of the water, and it's very strong evidence. One of the things I enjoy about knowing about this, and you can actually look at the image of it online, is there's this pillar that has kind of, it's hard to describe it without looking at it as well, but you can see succession of constellations that are really well carved in it. And as far as the dating of it, I'd have to like Google it right now, and I don't want to type because we made that rule beforehand. But maybe your jar is at Göbekli Tepe, our jar, the jar that will tell us about the true history of the nodes and why there's temples in India for both Rahu and Ketu, right? Like they have a relationship to these things. I want a deeper relationship too, Chris.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's like pre Stonehenge, I think, even, right?
Yes.
Yeah, there's some interesting stuff there in terms of some of the you know, prehistoric, almost astronomical and potentially astrological like monuments and things like that, and what their significance. I mean, the fact that Stonehenge is at all connected or aligned with the equinoxes and the solstices, and then, you know, Western astrology thousands of years later or hundreds of years after the creation of Stonehenge became so centered on the equinoxes and the solstices as the foundational pillars of the tropical zodiac has always just been fascinating to me. And there's always been some link there that I've meant to explore further that I'm not sure that I could articulate right now.
It's good to have interests like that go far back. They really do stretch the imagination, just like staring at the night sky, right?
Yeah. So bringing this back around to our what has become our main topic for this episode, which is the nodes.
The nodes.
I was thinking one of the issues that I have just theoretically or conceptually with the idea of that I've had for quite a while, for like 10 years since I got into traditional astrology, about the association of the nodes with past lives, is that we're talking about the nodes of the moon. And one of the issues that I had is that traditionally speaking, the moon was always associated with the body and with the physical incarnation of the native and all things sort of associated or related to that. Whereas the sun traditionally was what was associated with like the spirit and the soul and the intellect, at least in like ancient astrology, like 2000 years ago. And so there was always something that was a little bit weird about why then in modern astrology, you could even treat the nodes as having to do with reincarnation of the soul and like past and future lives, when we're talking about like mathematical points that are being derived primarily from the moon. But as I was sitting here thinking that earlier, like 30 minutes ago, as we were talking about something else, for the first time, I actually thought about it and came up with an actual argument that I could make, at least conceptually, as a counterpoint that's kind of interesting, which is that the nodes themselves are actually the intersection point between the path of the moon and the path of the sun.
Yeah.
So that's actually kind of interesting, where you could almost take it from a more traditional standpoint from 2000 years ago and say the moon's nodes represent the intersection point between the moon, which represents the body, and the sun, which represents the spirit or the soul. And so perhaps, and at one intersection point, the moon is moving upwards, and at one intersection point, the moon is moving downwards. And so perhaps from there, you could say this is why they have to do with past lives or future lives, because of the intertwining and the like moving in and out between those two spaces of like spirit versus body and soul versus, physical incarnation. So I literally just came up with that. So I'm not actually trying to promote
like
that.
It.
I feel like
I think you should. I think we should continue on it too.
All right. Well, I wanted to put that out there because I thought it was interesting, because I'm always interested in oftentimes like making, and sometimes I can see the holes when you go back and do like a historical reconstruction. You can point out the holes in something and make an argument against something, but then every once in a while I can think of like a counter argument that I could make in the opposite direction. And I just came up with that as a counter argument that I think somebody could make if they wanted to argue for the nodes symbolically, at least as indicative symbolically of past and future lives. I think that would be the best access point that I've ever come across, that I've ever seen anybody promote. And I think I just came up with it.
Bravo. Bravo.
Thank you. I'm sure somebody else has like said that at some point in the past, but I don't know. I just thought of that.
Well, when thinking about the thing that we have not mentioned up to this point, it kind of brings at least us into the territory of where you were just talking, and that's eclipses. So eclipses cannot happen without the nodes of the moon or without that intersection point, right?
Right.
And as you heard me talk about at the eclipse talk at your meetup, like, this is something that has fascinated me, in the sense that Rahu Ketu, this dragon-like Asura, is the one that, in a way, swallows sun and moon every 6 months or so. But when you look to many other cultures, it's always some sort of monstrous, very scary being. Like, out west, the Indians here, like, it was a bear, right? To the Vikings, it was two wolves. To the Tibetans, it was kind of like a flying dog creature, as far as I understand it. Chinese dragons. So there's this creature that represents something, and this is where I'm just tacking onto it, but I think it's really important, of like maybe the imprint, or maybe, here's my point that I've stumbled into many times contemplating the nodes and also working with them with people. It's just how reality is made of stories, right? And so, like, if the moon's glow is stolen sunlight, reduced by 500,000 times or something like that, then it's taking consciousness. The sun's our star. It's our reminder of the perfection of the cosmos, of consciousness, right? It's our star that gives life to us. And so the moon reflects that back. And in a sense, it is soma. It is somatic, that is, of body. But also the capacity, I think the moon is the closest thing to ego. I've never understood why some astrologers call the ego the sun. It doesn't make any sense to me. But the moon does. That it's this illusion of self that is found within our stories. And we are starved of stories, my friend. Like, all the stories are fading out. They've all been projected onto the Hollywood silver screen. And we're kind of rudderless, I think, in time. And so it's reclaiming these stories, the good ones that, in a way, help us to lead better lives and more magical lives and more spiritual existences. Those are the stories that we need to remember, because they're there. They turned up right on time about 5,000 years ago, right? And that has been my biggest interest, of like how to weave this in. Like, to imagine Joseph Campbell as an astrologer is kind of like where I think my work is headed, because that is what always pulls me. It pulls me. And it's the same thing as the nodes pulling at me, right? Like, that is just my addition to what you're saying, that there is some sort of sun and moon, masculine and feminine type alchemy happening in this neighborhood.
Yeah, and that connection with eclipses, which was so prominent, you know, what, just a month, month and a half ago, when everybody in North America, when millions of people went and witnessed this eclipse take place. I mean, that really raises some of the interesting things about the past history of the nodes as well, and why, you know, why in earlier traditions they were often interpreted negatively or as disruptive factors, because that is the point where, you know, the nodes are the intersection point between the path of the sun and the path of the moon. And when that happens, when there's a new moon that happens really close to the nodes, that means the moon will sometimes actually move in front of the face of the sun and block it for a period of time, and you'll have an eclipse. And that was often in ancient times viewed as an incredibly ominous phenomenon, because, you know, you're just going about your day and it's the middle of the day, it's like noon, and then suddenly it's just like dark out, and all the insects and the animals start freaking out because they think it's nighttime, and it just sort of throws things into chaos or into disorder, because there's something out of the ordinary that's just taken place that's interrupting the normal cycle of things. And I think that's a large part of the reason that sometimes you have these more disruptive and occasionally like negative takes on the nodes. Like Vedius Valens in the second century, he really had a thing where he felt like the moon, if it was conjunct or making a hard aspect with the nodes, was a really negative thing in electional charts. And he said that it's like he gets the most animated at this point. And it's really weird because you're reading this text from like this second century author, and then he just gets stuck on this one topic, and he goes on for like a couple of paragraphs about how things always go terribly whenever he has electional charts where the nodes are conjunct the moon or squaring the moon or something like that. And he says, never take any trips, don't get married, don't you know, start a business, don't do anything when the nodes are like that, because it will never turn out the way that you want it, and there will always be some sort of disruption.
Yeah.
And, you know, then later in the Indian tradition, the nodes are often interpreted as these sort of disruptive, you know, points in the chart as well, in a very similar way. And I think that connection with eclipses and that idea of disruption, I sort of understand it a little bit more now, after sort of witnessing that eclipse a couple of months ago.
A lover of the nodes, Valens was. Now, let me say this, how tragic and interesting, because I agree. When the moon is in relationship to the nodes of the moon, it is strange. Deja vu is frequent when it crosses. I've never seen it with squares as much, but like when it crosses the south node or the north node, that's been a common theme. And there's that feeling, right? Have I been here before? Or has it yet not happened, but it's going to, right? There's that like feeling within deja vu that I have noticed, because it's so easy. Like I have a phone in my pocket with an astrology app. If I had deja vu, I pull it out. And if the moon's there, well, Now, last night, according to Valens, like don't do certain things when the moon is in relationship to the nodes. Well, when that Aquarius moon crossed over the south node on the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay, that crazy fuck opened fire on the crowd. You know this news story already, right? Yeah.
Right, the shooting in Las Vegas last night.
Yeah, it was within 5 degrees of the south node when that happened.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I haven't, I haven't experimented with that too much. I've tried to pay attention to that, and I'm still trying to get a sense for that. But that idea of, you know, there just being chaos sometimes when the luminaries get in that area is kind of an interesting and kind of potent metaphor, and just it's a very different way of approaching it, I feel like, than the sort of contemporary take on the nodes, which is almost in some ways the exact opposite, because it's much more like linear of like, this is the future, this is an arrow that's pointed towards your future, and then this is an arrow that's pointed towards your past. Whereas this other take is much more like, this is an area of nebulousness and chaos and sort of a wild card factor.
They are chaos. And that's what the eclipses are too. I think that the unexpected events where you do brush up on things like dragons during them. And it can of course happen outside of eclipses, or maybe it's eclipse season that accentuates it a little bit more. But it is interesting as far as like you think you're going this way and then you enter that territory. And then by the, like, once you pop out of the other side of it, you're actually heading a completely different direction. It could happen like that.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense in terms of the just the symbolism and the moon moving from the north to the south and suddenly changing hemispheres and declination and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, we are an hour and a half into our first question. So,
yep.
I think
that's
this,
right.
We are going to have to change the title of this episode because it's clearly become the nodes episode with Adam and Chris. Where should we go from here? I don't know that we can, we could try to like work in one more question and just make it like a, whatever, a 2-hour episode. We could just call this a self-contained episode on the nodes. What are you feeling like?
Yeah, let's entitle it the accidental nodes episode.
Right. The disruptive nature of the nodes on our previous plans to answer several questions.
I'm fine with it. And yeah, I mean, if we do this in the future, maybe we can focus on one question again and just be like Adam and Chris riff on a subject, whatever that subject might be.
Yeah, that sounds good because there was going to be another one. There was a couple more, and we actually kind of almost incidentally got to or answered or did sort of short answers of some of them in terms of the Dasha's one, and there was another one about the sort of cognitive dissonance that arises in terms of practicing astrology in the modern world where the modern understanding of the cosmos is so different. Yeah. But maybe we could get into some specific answers on some of these in a follow-up episode on your podcast.
Yeah, let's do part two on my show. And remember, everyone listening, don't believe anything that you read or we say about the nodes. Experience them for yourself. Then you will know what we're talking about, or at least what I'm talking about, because I'm a full believer in their nature. You're still getting acquainted, I suppose.
Yeah, I agree. Go back and both try them and test them out and do that empirical work to see how they work in your chart and in your life and in your transits. And then also, you know, go back and do that conceptual work and then symbolic work, as well as, you know, in that thread is also the historical work of seeing what other people have said in different traditions about the nodes. And then from the merging of those two, maybe draw some conclusions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the simplest way. I mean, just to keep the psychology that I think is kind of traditional as well. When looking at them, be like, North Node represents bringing in more content for the story that you're supposed to write, so it's more. South Node is releasing and burning the pages of the stories that no longer serve you. And so you can see that with transits to the nodes and also the nodes transiting houses and planets in your chart.
Right. And I do want to say that the thing that got me to realize I needed to start paying attention to the nodes again was an empirical observation. I think it was during the 2012 election where I was doing a blog, a website called the Political Astrology Blog at the time with my friend Patrick Watson. And one of the things we did is like live coverage of the Democratic National Convention and the Republican National Convention. And it was kind of fun because we sat with like a group of people online and we watched through the major speeches each night of both conventions. And we had like a solar fire chart up that showed the transits in that location at that moment, both in just like the chart of the moment and the animated clock feature, but also the transits to the chart of the person who was giving a speech at that point. Mm-hmm. And we actually watched Paul Ryan actually got up and gave a speech where, you know, in 2012, he was Mitt Romney's running mate for vice president. And he had like the North Node. It was like, I think it was like the North Node, like transiting perfectly over his, what I think was like a 0 degrees Sagittarius ascendant with Neptune very closely conjuncted at 0 degrees or something like that. And the North Node passed over, and I believe this is the true node. And then it was like right during or right after his speech, it clicked over and it changed signs and it moved off of his ascendant. And it was like this really powerful sort of observation that there was this political figure and that he just had this major transit and just gave a major speech in terms of being important for his career and presumably his overall destiny and life direction and things like that. And that the nodes were clearly playing some sort of prominent role in his chart at the time. And that was the thing. That was the point after my sort of like 10-year almost sojourn of trying to get the nodes out of my charts and then trying to figure out what everything else means and then build my understanding back up. That was the point at which I was like, okay, I need to start paying attention to these points because they clearly mean something important. And even if I don't precisely know what, I want to explore that and figure it out. So that's still where I'm at, but that's what I would recommend other people do as well.
That's a great recommendation. And I'm happy you're back with us and you'll be riding dragons soon enough, my friend.
Yes, I've rejoined the club and hopefully this will not end up being like an embarrassing episode like 20 years from now if I decide to write like a book about the nodes and the nodes become like my main thing. Hopefully this episode has fallen into, you know, quiet secrecy by that point.
No way. And also they'll have found the jar with that manuscript that we need.
Right. And it's like the founder of Western astrology. It's like Nicepso and Petisirus, two of the mythical founders of Western astrology. And they're basically just talking about how the South Node indicates one's past life and the North Node indicates one's future life.
And they start talking about dragons in the way that I do as well. It's like, oh my God, they were onto something.
Right.
We're just remembering.
And then literally overnight, like everybody in the EA community would become a traditional astrologer and would be on board with like recovering the text of the ancient traditions.
We would all be friends.
Right.
One tree, under one tree. Oh, goodness.
Someday we can hope. All right. Well, I think that brings us then to a good stopping point for this episode. So this turned out to be, as our last conversation did, an amazing conversation. I don't know what it is. We're going to have to look at our synastry or something, or maybe it's just both of our...
I know something. Want to know it?
What is it? Good.
Because your chart's on astro.com. I've looked at it before.
Right.
I know two things. One, your sun is on my moon. Your sun's at 9 Sat or Scorpio, right?
Yeah.
My moon's 8 Scorpio.
Oh, brilliant. Beautiful.
So that's one. And then our angles are flipped. So your MC is 5 Sag, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
My MC is 6 Gemini. So we're a degree of separation.
Interesting. Okay. What's your rising again?
6 Virgo.
Virgo. Okay. Got it. Interesting. Yeah. Those are some pretty close synastry contacts. So I think we've got something good going on here and I'm excited about it. We do have an issue with sticking to outlines or not punctuality, but something along those lines. But I think it ends up being fruitful and productive. So I'm really glad that we got a chance to do this tonight. And yeah. I'm looking forward to doing some follow-ups and getting to some of these other questions, next time on your podcast as our next foray into these long-winded discussions.
Let's try it with a Virgo moon instead of the Pisces moon. See what happens.
Good
Maybe
idea.
Maybe we'll be more organized.
Yeah. Applied electional astrology in practice. That is a good idea.
Beautiful, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks for joining me. Everyone should check out your website. What's the URL for that again?
Yes. Holestoheavens.com. That's plural. And then you can find my podcast just like you probably find Chris's on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, whatever. And it's the Exploring Astrology Podcast.
Brilliant. Well, everybody should go check that out. And you're pretty, I mean, you're on the ball about how many episodes do you do a month? Do you have a specific set amount or is it just vary?
I do 4 and one of them is only available for patrons.
Brilliant. All right. Yeah. Well, yeah. Everyone should definitely check out your website through that URL. And I think if you liked our conversation here today, you'll really enjoy the rest of the content you've been producing for nearly 10 years now.
Thanks, Chris. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks everyone for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Good night.